Last night, Governor Scott Walker gave his second state biennial budget address. Included in that budget are some big plans for transportation, workforce development, public K-12 education and voucher schools, and Medicaid. And this hour, we welcome two state representatives from Western Wisconsin, a Democrat and a Republican, to give their analysis of and insight into this massive piece of legislation right here on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'm glad to introduce my guests. Joining us by phone from his home in Abbotsford, I'd like to welcome Scott Suter. He's a Republican state representative from Abbotsford and is also the Assembly Majority Leader. Scott Suter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate being here.
And next, I'd like to welcome Democrat State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau, who also joins us by phone from his home. Chris Dano, thank you for being part of the discussion as well.
Thank you for having me as well.
And this chat would not be complete without contributions from our listeners. What do you think of the governor's budget proposal? What do you like about it? What don't you like? Give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615 to get on the air on the West Side. Now, I want to start off with Representative Suter, and I just wanted to know, obviously, you guys, both of you are in the know down in Madison, but I'm wondering, Representative Suter, did anything about the governor's budget proposal or his speech, did anything surprise you?
Well, there were a few surprises, certainly not in the speech necessarily, but in the budget itself. I think both Chris and I can agree that the Walker administration has been very tight-lipped in terms of releasing only parcels of this budget. And, you know, we've seen a lot of it released prior to the speech, but there were a few surprises. Some that I think we like, some that I think that we're going to take a look at. But I think it's important for people to note that, look, this is the beginning of the process, not the end, and there's going to be changes made throughout, both in the Joint Finance Committee as well as in probably both houses. So this is a long process. Sometimes some would argue a painful process, but it's a necessary process because changes will be made, and I think all of us, Democrats and Republicans alike, are now in the mode of listening to our constituents, getting feedback, and making changes if necessary in the document.
And Representative Dana, what about you? Any surprises?
Oh, I think to some extent, no. What I found, if I were to say the thing I found most interesting about what the governor had to say and his approach is, and I think most people who are in the know and who kind of analyze political rhetoric recognize this as sort of, it's clearly the opening of the governor's some sort of national campaign for the governor. The some of the language he used, some of the things he was doing were clearly aimed at a national audience, particularly a national Republican primary audience. So that to me, I think, is the most interesting dynamic, and it's kind of par for the course with the governor. He too typically is clearly started always been looking ahead. When he was Milwaukee County exec, he was looking ahead to his governor's race, and I suspect now he views himself as a potential candidate, a very strong potential candidate for the Republican nomination in the next presidential cycle. And I think that's what you saw with this budget was a movement in that direction by the governor.
Pretty interesting. Representative Suter, did you hear any national undertones in this or any bigger aspirations in that speech?
Well, I guess I'm pleased that Chris has such high regard for Governor Walker that you'd make him a presidential candidate already. But, I saw a lot of what we've seen from Scott Walker throughout his entire career, frankly, in terms of reform. This is a reform budget. It's as a result of the last budget, which was also a reform budget, and there were some deep cuts in that budget. As a result of those choices, we now have a surplus, and you're seeing how this governor would like to utilize that surplus and the investments that he's making, whether it's in workforce development or transportation or even domestic violence funding. There are some serious choices that are made here, and you know we can certainly have our disagreements on those choices, but the fact remains we went from a $3.6 billion deficit to now a major surplus and in a much better situation where we can actually do investments and put more money into key programs, in particular workforce development and transportation, which I think are not necessarily Democrat or Republican issues. Those are issues that all of us talked about in the last campaigns, and I think there are some major investments there that we deserve attention, and the governor is certainly moving toward that direction.
First, I'd want to talk about what I think is going to be a big news to a lot of all citizens, really, and that's the tax cut that the governor announced last night and in his budget, that there'd be about $343 million in tax cuts for low income and the bottom three tax brackets. Chris Dana, is this what Wisconsin needs right now? I mean, is this going to help stimulate the economy through people having more money in their pockets?
Well, if you look at the amounts we're talking about, and, again, these are based on some averages, but the average, a family of four making $80,000 would get about $100 annually. That's $2 a week. That's clearly not an amount that is, and that's a family, $2 a week. That's maybe a cup of coffee. The amount of actual tax cut to the individual that the individual citizen is going to see is going to be so small as to be, quite frankly, meaningless. But, when you take it in aggregate, of course, it sounds pretty good. It's, $350 million or so. But the actual savings that any one individual, any family are going to see are going to be so inconsequential as to be almost meaningless, while at the same time hurting the state's ability to make some of the necessary improvements and needs. I mean, we did not claw back at all some of the damage, the tremendous damage we did to our public school system, and that's gonna be a huge issue that we come up back with. And I can tell you, most of my constituents would gladly put $2 a week to make sure our rural schools get the kind of funding they need. I find very few people would be opposed to that approach, and I think that's what I dislike about a lot of elements of the government. There's a lot of kind of fluff and talk, but comes to doing the real important hard things we need to do, that was a huge one, and that one's one that's going to hurt us.
And before I go to Representative Souter, I want to know, who has the bird?
That's me. Well, you can actually hear it. He's ways.
Okay. And never mind. I just heard I had to comment. I can't help it. But Representative Souter, inconsequential, $2 a week or, $100 a year for some families?
Well, I just want to first say, Chris, you're driving my cat crazy. The cat wants the bird. Fight between the species. It's an income tax cut. It's going to result in between four middle-class taxpayers. This is targeted at the middle class. It's going to result in about a 2-3% lowering of tax rates for most individuals. And, again, this is a permanent tax cut. This is not just a one-time rebate. This is a tax cut. So people are going to be paying less, hence they're going to have more in their pockets, more to invest. And if they choose to invest that in, that's their choice. But I think the key is, we now are taking a part of that surplus and giving it back in terms of an income tax cut for people to make sure that, they're paying less in their taxes. That is a far cry from Washington, a stark contrast in terms of what, they're doing out there in terms of, they're making massive cuts potentially with regard to the sequester and talking about tax increases. So I think it's going to not only help, and while it may not be enough for some people, over the course of time, over the course of 10 years, it will be real money. It will be a situation where people are paying less on their taxes as a result, and it's going to be better for us overall in the economy because people have more money, more discretionary income to spend. That's going to help create jobs. It's going to create a better fiscal atmosphere for us statewide. But it's a question of, look, would you rather have an income tax cut or would you rather have tax increases? And because of the choices we made, we are able to give tax cuts, and the federal government is doing quite the opposite. So I think most people would agree with us that, yeah, we're happy with the choices you made. Yes, you're giving money back. That's a far cry and a heck of a lot better than increasing our taxes.
And do we know where the money is coming from for these tax cuts, or where it's going to? Is it this directly coming from the surplus, or is this going to?
Well, you got to look at it this way, Rich. I mean, it's money that will not be spent on critical things we need. We've dealt a tremendous blow to our public schools in the last biennium. one of the largest cut in most people's memory to our public education system. The governor is doing virtually nothing to reverse that cut, or even the amount he actually puts back into our public schools is again a relatively small amount and not enough to offset the tremendous damage that was done last time. I mean, that's the choice you're looking at, quite frankly, because taxes are GPR, it's general purpose revenue, and that typically, well, bulk of that, a lot of that goes to our public education system. That means that money will not be there for our small rural schools that are critical to maintaining the quality of life we have in large parts of the state, particularly our rural areas.
Well, let's not forget that as a result of the reforms we did last session, we did give not only schools the tools to manage their budgets better. I mean, that gets lost in the debate here, but that is the truth. And we found over $2 billion in savings as a result of those reforms. So this is not a cut to education. We gave schools and school districts and educators the tools to better manage their budgets in many, many cases to the tune of $2 billion. They were able to do so. So to say that, you know, this is money that's coming for education, I think is not accurate. But an income tax rate cut for the middle class, that is exactly what we heard from a lot of people, both Democrats and Republicans in the last campaign, and Governor Walker's delivering on it. And I think that's a success, and it's something that should be praised. And frankly, I actually hope it's going to be more, and I would hope that our team in the Assembly and in the Senate actually increases that. But it is a very good start. A tax cut is much, much better than a tax increase.
Since we're speaking about schools and school funding, I'd like to get right into one of the topics that's been, you know, front and center in as far as news reports of the governor's budget, and that is the voucher program. And, you know, it's one of the more controversial parts of the budget. The governor plans to expand voucher schools statewide and in districts that have more than 4,000 students and at least one school receiving a failing grade from the state. Representative Souter, will this help students in your district?
Well, it's going to be a choice. I mean, a lot of the schools in my district do a great job, and so the choices that parents are going to make, I would presume they're very happy with many of the schools. But the schools statewide that are failing, what we've seen in Milwaukee in terms of Milwaukee public schools, those kids are getting a better education, and taxpayers are getting a savings as a result. And if that helps children, because those children are not Democrats or Republicans. We're talking about children's success. And if competition in the system helps with that success and helps move those children forward, I think that's a good thing. And you know what? There will be some additional competition. Whether that's in my district or not, I don't know. But that's going to depend on how those schools are doing. And I think everyone, every parent, no matter what their political affiliation, they want their kids to have the best education possible. And that's what the governor's trying to do here, is trying to inject competition where necessary so that those kids have a choice, and those parents have a choice to go to the school that they want to make sure their kids are doing the very best possible.
Now, before we go to Representative Dano, I want to let listeners know that they can join in the conversation. We're talking about the governor's biennial budget proposal that he gave last night and the some of the finer details in the budget itself. The number to call in is 800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. And there have been some Republicans that have been against the idea of expanding the voucher school program. One notable example is Senate President Mike Ellis. Representative Souter, is there a rift in the Republican Party over this issue?
No, not a rift. There's various disagreement in terms of how to approach school choice. That's true, and that's fair. But I think overall, I think most of us agree that it's a question of how fast you go and how you do it. Now, Senator Ellis thinks we should. He's not necessarily against school choice. He just thinks it should be done in a different method. And we're certainly going to take a look at that. But the fact remains, I think, you have both Democrats and Republicans, not all of them, who know that school choice has worked and are willing to move that program forward, not necessarily statewide, but certainly in areas that we have failing schools. And You know, that I think it has worked in other states, certainly worked in Milwaukee. It's working in Racine, and I see no reason why it can't work in other areas of the state as well.
Representative Souter, Representative Dano, what about your district? Will this help?
You know, here's the thing. This is money, and keep in mind, with the expansion of money to the voucher schools, this is money that will no longer be available to public schools. That is money that is essentially being taken out of the pockets of the people of my district and going into the pockets of the people who run these unaccountable voucher schools. The thing you have to keep in mind about these voucher schools is there is no accountability there. They're not subject to the same kind of testing standards that public schools are as far as testing their students and their test scores to see what their performance levels are. They're not subject to the kind of requirements for teacher certification, evaluation, and grading. And they're also, quite frankly, and if you look at what's gone on, a lot of them have proven to be very troubling. I mean, I can look across the river in Minnesota and see what's happened at a voucher school over there. They hired somebody with a criminal background because they didn't do an adequate background check, and that person ended up molesting students at the school. Now, that's the kind of thing that deeply concerns me. We're taking taxpayer money, funneling it directly to schools that have virtually no accountability, no reporting requirements, and could, quite frankly, and the one element that they never really discuss about with this is those schools have the ability to cherry-pick their students. They don't have to serve everybody. They can turn people away. They can turn away the kid with special needs. They can turn away the kid with ADHD. Our public schools don't have that option. So that's where a lot of those comparisons between vouchers and private schools and the public schools are very, very often very unfair and often prove highly inaccurate. And the studies that have come out have shown that voucher schools, even though they do have a self-selecting population, perform no better than public schools. And again, they are totally unaccountable. This is your taxpayer money and mine. It's going to be going to schools that have virtually no accountability standards. I think anybody who's a taxpayer, regardless of what you think about public versus private schools, would want those schools to at least be accountable to the taxpayer for the results and the money that they spend, if it's taxpayer money.
Now I'd like to speak about there were some 710 new employees that the governor wants to add that's included in this budget or the funding to add those employees. And two in particular have to do with the frac sand mining industry. I'm speaking about the DNR and their air quality division. Governor Walker, the DNR requested and Governor Walker approved, or in his budget, he's suggesting that the legislature approve funding for two additional people to keep an eye on the air quality or air emissions from frac sand mining operations. And Representative Souter, you were quoted in the Marshfield Herald, I believe, as saying that this was in response to the request by the DNR, that I think there are adequate staff at the DNR to work with the frac sand plants and enforce the laws. I have yet to see justification to add staff in an area where they are not overburdened. Are you upset, Representative Souter, that the governor is urging the legislature to fund these positions?
No, it's not a matter of, you know, my perspective is this on any of those positions, and there's a lot of new positions. I am skeptical each and every one of them until it's proven that the need is there. And with regard to the two individuals at the DNR, it has not been shown to me by the DNR, and I've asked them, why they need those additional two positions when they do have individuals in the agency that perform that testing. So I'm not sure the reason for it. If they can justify that, you know, to the legislature, fine. So it's not that, and you know, I've never been accused of wanting to add employees to the DNR, but again, if they can justify it, if the need is there, if there is an actual health concern, or if they are overburdened and they don't have enough people, then I can, I can stomach it. But I just don't want to be adding positions for the sake of adding positions just because it sounds good and just because, you know, some people think they need it. It has to be justified because it's taxpayer money. And these are permanent positions. So that's how I look at it for any one of these positions, whether they're in DOT or DNR or any agency, frankly.
Well, to follow up on that, I spoke with the regional director of the air quality program. I can't think of his name right now, but here in Eau Claire, about this. And he said that right now there is about four staff for this region, which is a big chunk of the state, to monitor the air quality or the compliance of all industry in that region. And we've seen frac sand mining companies, just the industry, really boom in western Wisconsin. I think there's been some accounts that there's nearly 100 facilities now. So four people and in charge of monitoring that many facilities, is that not a justified need?
Well, I can't pretend to be an expert in air quality, but I've never met an agency director or anyone in an agency that says they have too few people. So I'm a little skeptical going in when someone, because every agency, if you look at their request, they always want more staff, they always need more people, it's never enough. I look at it in terms of, look, if you absolutely need it, and if there is, if you can justify it, you know, we'll take a look at it. But I do have a skeptical eye when it comes to agencies, whether they're Republican or Democrat, asking for more people, because they always do this, no matter what, who's in charge. And I kind of look at it and sure. go, well, let's see. If you can justify it, tell me how, and maybe we'll vote for it. But we're not going to be a rubber stamp for this governor or any governor. I think you have to look at that, at each individual program on its merits, and if they can stand the test, great. If they don't, then maybe we won't authorize it. So we're going to look at each program and go through. Like I said, this is the beginning of the process. There's going to be a lot of kicks with Cat here, and this document will change, and we're all going to have a chance to.
And Representative Dano, your district is right in the heart of frac sand mining territory.
Well, let me just address that real quickly. I wish the Representative Souter would have been as concerned about changes in staffing and all that when we created the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation last session, and they ended up losing track of millions of dollars of taxpayer money. I wish he would have been as skeptical about that program. I mean, clearly, there's been a massive expansion of the frac sand industry in Wisconsin over the past couple of years, and we've heard that one of the challenges is making sure that there's adequate monitoring of the industry. And you know, part of what's frustrating when I hear this Scott say these things is the state across the state we have roughly about a 10% vacancy rate in most state aid. I mean, it's about an average across the state. And we often hear from businesses, for instance, we're very frustrated that we can't get permits done on time, that we can't get the paperwork processed. Well, part of that is because we don't have enough staff to do it. And for the most part, I know there tends to be some priority, but things tend to get dealt with in the order they come in by most state bureaucracies when I talk to people. And if they don't have adequate staffing to deal with the appropriate and necessary paperwork, it's going to slow things down. And, if we want to have, we talk about having a good business climate, part of that is staffing our agencies in a way that they can actually respond to people's concerns and requests in a timely, efficient, and effective manner. And if you understaff, you actually literally undercut the ability of agencies to be effective in doing what they do. And that's been a constant thing we've heard from folks. I heard from funeral directors there isn't enough staff to adequately process toxicology results for death certificates. So there's delays in getting people insurance payments. That leads to delays and people paying their funeral directors. I mean, those are the kind of things that we often neglect and fail to think about when we talk about how we staff our state agencies. You have to have them staffed adequately so they can actually do their job.
But Chris,
of course, when they don't do that, then sure. It feeds into the Republican narrative that government is bad and inefficient. Well, no place is efficient if you don't adequately or effectively staff them.
But Chris, simply adding more staff doesn't help necessarily with efficiency. What we're doing, we're looking at the opposite and saying, look, there are too many rules and regulations that are so confusing for businesses, whether small or large, across the board, that, of course, there's the mammoth amount of paperwork. Those staff may be overburdened, but not because, we don't need more employees. We need less rules and regulations, or at the very least to streamline them to make it have some common sense. You should have less paperwork. Thereby, we should reduce the burden on those individuals, but adding more staff and adding more rules and regulations, I think, is the wrong way to go. So there's two perspectives, and ours is, reform government and make it easier for businesses to succeed by reducing the amount of paperwork and reducing the amount of red tape. And again, if you can justify staff after we do that, fine. But we want to do this twofold. We want to justify those positions, but also reduce the amount of red tape out there. It's mammoth, and it's strangling small business.
We are talking about the governor's second biennial budget proposal and his biennial budget this hour on the West Side with State Democrat Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau and Republican State Representative Scott Souter of Abbotsford. We'd like to hear from our listeners as well. The number to call in if you've got a question or a comment is 1-800-228-5615. We've got one caller on the line. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll be right back. and we'll get to the phones. So stay tuned to the West Side, and if you have a question or comment, 800-228-5615.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Scott, Huggies, and Kotex brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 140-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com. Support also comes from UW-Eau Claire Theater, presenting Deflator Mouse, which follows partygoers through a series of mistaken identities, liaisons, and deceits at Gantner Concert Hall from February 21st through March 3rd. More at 800-949-UWEC.
It's the culmination of an effort to devise a plan for preserving America's recorded history. We'll talk with Patrick Lockney at the Library of Congress. James Boyd Brent is this year's juror for Arts West 34. It opens Sunday in Eau Claire. He joins us. Jim Oliver welcomes cast members from the Menominee Theater Guild production of Pirates of Penzance. And Claude Schilling is one of the curators of the art exhibits that make the Chippewa Valley Regional Airport a nicer place to wait. Catch it all on Spectrum West at 5 p.m. tomorrow on this Ideas Network station.
I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm joined by Republican State Representative Scott Suter of Abbotsford and Democrat State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau, and we're talking about the governor's biennial budget proposal. If you'd like to voice your thoughts on the governor's budget proposal, give us a call, 800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. We're going to go to the phones now, and in the town of Washington, we've got Dave on the line. Dave, thanks for calling in to the West Side. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you, Rich. It's important to have this program so we can become informed about the budget. I think that's all of our duty as citizens. And I had two questions for Representative Suter, if I might, one related to the transportation funding and the other health care. And maybe we can talk transportation first, because I think that's the easiest question to ask. And
go ahead.
Allow him to provide a concise answer. The governor set up a task force a while back, I think headed by his own secretary of the Department of Transportation, to look at how we might fund the transportation. I understand there was a $2 billion shortfall over the next 10 years. And the task force came back with a number of tools. I like to use that word. I know Representative Suter likes to use it as well. But the governor seems to be ignoring those tools, which called for funding the projects, actually paying for them as we go along. Instead, the governor is proposing to cut funding from other worthwhile programs and also borrow money to do the necessary transportation infrastructure work in the state. Why is that, Representative Suter? Why not embrace some of the tools and pay for these projects as we go along?
Well, let's start with the secretary's recommendations. He did put together a number of individuals, and they came up with a number, and I would call it just a series of tax increases. And a lot of those tax increases were simply dead on arrival, and I have been very public about that. Okay. We're not going to do a gas tax increase, period. Not going to happen. Even if the governor were to put it in the budget, it would not fly, but the governor did not. Putting some type of monitoring device in individuals' cars to see how long they drive and charging them accordingly, that's done on arrival. I think there's serious privacy concerns with that. That simply was not going to fly with many Republicans and Democrats. And the rest were just, I would argue, were tax increases and not the right way to go. If anyone was cherry-picking, it was that commission. And those ideas, while they have merit in some cases, they're not going to fly politically. They're just not going to make it through the legislature. So those recommendations, most of which are off the table. The governor did make major investments in infrastructure, and I think we're going to have to take a look at that. I know that there are a couple of Republicans that are concerned about the amount of bonding, and I think that's a legitimate concern. So we're going to take a look at the amount of bonding in this budget. But if you look at, you know, the amounts that are being presented by the governor in terms of investments, he is making a major investment both in terms of GPR monies for this, but he's also making investments for dam repair, for rail, for freight rail, for all kinds of transportation needs and necessities. So he's making major investments and making sure that not only we do the projects that we need to do, but that we're paying off what we need to pay off. And let's not forget, I mean, we just passed on a bipartisan note The Transportation Protection Amendment that's going to go to before the people in 2014 to make sure there are no raids ever again by any governor or legislature on the transportation fund. There were raids to the tune of $1.3 billion. That did hurt. That hurt our transportation fund, and we're not going to do that again. So not only did we solve that, and the people are obviously going to decide, and I think they're overwhelmingly going to favor that and put that in the Constitution, but we are making investments in this budget. So, whether it's enough, I'm not sure. I think some would argue it's too much bonding. But, we'll shake that out as we go through the process. But the fact is we're able to make those investments because of the choices we made 2 years ago. And it's better to have, some money and a surplus rather than a huge, massive debt like we had 2 years ago.
Now, Dave, before we go with the second question, I'd like to give Representative Dano a chance to respond as well.
If you look at what happened, and you talk, Representative Souter talks about gas taxes and things. When he voted to eliminate the gas tax indexing a number of years ago, and I believe he was there and voted for it, I wasn't at that point. It cost the state since that period of time about $500 million in additional revenue that would have gone into transportation. Those are the kind of choices you're talking about. When you're talking about, and essentially what we're doing with this budget for transportation is we're raiding the general fund to fund the transportation budget. I mean, that's essentially what you're being done. And when you raid the general fund has traditionally not been used for most transportation projects. When you raid the general fund, you're essentially pitting I hate to say this, but you're pitting schools against kids to some extent. And that's the kind of thing that happens if you don't look at doing the appropriate things as far as road funding. Just for example, for the sake of a gas tax. With a gas tax, at least everybody who uses the road at least pays something. That includes people traveling in the state from Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, anywhere from other states. Commercial companies from other states that are using our roads are helping to pay for them. By eliminating those kinds of things, guess what that means? That means the burden then falls entirely upon the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, or more of it does, that falls on the citizens of the state of Wisconsin instead of getting some of that additional revenue from out-of-state sources who are actually utilizing our roads. Those are the kind of things that happen when you get locked into this mentality that there will not be a revenue increase or a tax increase. It's about being smart about it. And we are going to have to pay for these roads somehow in the long run. And we are using a large amount of bonding and borrowing to do it, and I think it's, in the long run, very irresponsible. You can't have it both ways. And we've seen that far too often with wanting to have it both ways, and we're in a situation where we're not going to be able to have it both ways for a whole lot longer. The rubber will hit the road literally and figuratively over the next few years.
Dave, you had another question or a comment regarding Medicaid? Go ahead.
Yes, and just one final comment regarding the transportation fund. It seems that we are going to borrow. We say bonding, but that means borrowing. So once again, we're not paying our way. That would be my comment.
Sure.
With regard to Medicaid, I listened very carefully last night to the governor, and he talked about the exchanges that would be made available to those folks that were above the 100% poverty level. In other words, he's not accepting the offer from the federal government to include more people in Medicaid. He's saying that anyone above 100% of the poverty level could join one of the exchanges, which he has not been in favor of at all. He turned away, I believe, $36 million, which the federal government had offered to set up exchanges in Wisconsin.
Sure.
He said no, he didn't like exchanges, wasn't going to accept the money. The feds could come in and set it up. And now it seems like he's throwing a lot of probably poor people into a program that he himself doesn't believe in, doesn't want to have anything to do with. And I think he mentioned last night in his speech that people above the 100% poverty level could buy insurance for as cheap as $19 a month. And if that is the case, maybe state employees, representatives, and so on could buy that insurance too and save us a whole lot of money if that is in fact the case. So I'd like Representative Souter to comment on that, if he would, please.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. And a reminder for anyone else listening, you can give a call and ask a question or a comment to either of our guests regarding the governor's budget at 800-228-5615. Representative Souter?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, but yeah. I think what the governor has done and suggested, and again, this is the first part of the process, is to reform health care entitlements. And under his plan, what he said last night was that we're going to reduce the number of uninsured adults by about 225,000 about a 47% reduction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the goal. And in terms, he did state that, you know, there would be a, I guess I would call it a hybrid in terms of the exchanges and in terms of what he's going to do in terms of reforming to the extent we can here in the state of Wisconsin, the way we do Medicaid. But at the same time, I do have to, you know, defend the governor on this. There are those that simply will say that, oh, we should have just taken the money and called it a day. Well, the problem is the federal government does not have a solid history of making good on its promises, particularly financially. And I give the governor credit for not wanting to put taxpayers on the hook, you know, into the next decade, and money that may not be there, that will have to make up in future budgets, because there's a lot of times the federal government does not keep its promises. And you know, I think you have to be cognizant of that. To simply take money up front, hoping the money's going to be there in the end, I think is dangerous. So I think what the governor's doing is taking a balanced approach, but also the goal, and I think for a goal for everyone, is to reduce the number of uninsured, and he's doing that under his plan. There's a 47% reduction goal for those in terms of uninsured adults. So I think it's a good start. We may make changes, but at the same time, I'm very, very skeptical of promises that the federal government makes with upfront money, because they usually don't deliver, whether it's transportation or Medicaid.
And Representative Dana, what are your thoughts on the governor's decision to not accept the federal money?
Well, I think clearly this was an example of his playing to a sort of a national Republican type of right-wing audience. I mean, even Rick Scott, who's probably arguably one of the most right-wing governors down in Florida, decided to accept the money for expansion down there. So I clearly he's doing this as a play, as part. I think that's the unfortunate thing. It's an ideological driver. It's ideology and politics driving the decision as opposed to what's really good for the state of Wisconsin. What this is going to end up doing, quite frankly, in a nutshell, is it will cost us about $42 million in revenue this biennium. And in the law, and will essentially result, quite frankly, if you look at it in a nutshell, in fewer people being covered, getting insurance, and costing the state of Wisconsin more money, all in pursuit of an ideological agenda and a national political ambitions. This is another example of what he did with the train money. That would have been potentially hugely beneficial to the state of Wisconsin in the long run, $800 million in economic development aid that he sent away, and, you know, for ideological reasons. And this is the kind of thing, quite frankly.
No, because it was a high-speed choo-choo train that nobody wanted, Chris.
Well,
I mean, sorry,
this is the kind of...
That train was never going through your district or my district, and it was a boondoggle that the train was made in Spain, and nobody wanted it except for a few individuals who thought a train was a good idea that nobody was going to ride. So, we've argued on this before. It's kind of fun, but
one at a time, please, gentlemen.
What it boils down to is we see an ideological agenda being pursued at the expense of what's good policy for the state of Wisconsin, the people of Wisconsin, just in pure dollars and cents terms, just based on a very simple analysis that this will cost the people of the state more money and result in fewer people being covered, as simply as I can put that.
And with that, we're talking about the governor's biennial budget proposal given last night. We've got State Representative and Assembly Majority Leader Scott Suter of Abbotsford on the line and Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau. We'll have more from our guests, and we'll also, if time allows, try to get into the discussion about the iron mining bill that is working its way through the legislature. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-228-5615. We still have time to take a couple calls. That number again, 800-228-5615. This is The West Side.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company. ATC provides a pathway for power into communities throughout Wisconsin. ATC owns and operates the high-voltage electric transmission system that helps keep the lights on, businesses running, and communities strong. Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering online and phone loan applications for student loans, consolidation, vehicles, a line of credit, and more. Information is online at wisconsincu.org.
Preserving our recordings at the Library of Congress. Arts West 34 opens and we meet the juror. The Pirates of Penzance opens in Menominee, and frequent flyers get frequent art at the Chippewa Valley Airport. That and more on Spectrum West, 5 p.m. tomorrow on this Ideas Network station.
Welcome back to The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and thanks for joining us this hour on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the governor's biennial budget and his proposal that he gave last night. We are also joined by Republican State Representative Scott Suter of Abbotsford and Democrat State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau. The number to call in with questions or comments for either guest is 1-800-228-5615. And, gentlemen, I wanted to bring up what was kind of a theme last night in the governor's speech, and that is reducing people's dependency on government and creating independence through the private sector. And basically, what one of the parts of that in the governor's budget is the changes in the food stamps program and how Wisconsin administers it. The governor has announced that Wisconsin will now require those receiving food stamps to either find work or enroll in a worker training program to qualify. Representative Dano, is this an attempt to force people out of the program, or is this just common sense?
Well, it all depends on how you structure the program. I mean, you have to structure it in a way that makes it, you know, often you're dealing with people who are in very difficult circumstances with any number of issues, probably don't have good transportation, often have child care issues that they have difficulty with. You know, in theory, I don't have a problem with it. Again, a lot of it's that the devil is in the details. It does sort of smack of, you know, the old let's vilify, you know, people who are receiving any sort of government assistance. And that's been a consistent theme that, you know, that the governor's party has consistently pushed. I mean, you heard it with the comments Mitt Romney said, that anybody, you know, that if you were in a situation finding yourself in the need of government assistance, that you're somehow a bad person. And it's often an element that plays to that there. But like I said, if it's done in a reasonable way and it actually truly benefits people, I think we can do it. But again, the devil will be in the details with something like that.
Sure. And Representative Souter, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's very clear that, you know, nobody's vilifying anyone. In fact, we're trying to help people. Look, I don't think anybody really wants to be on government assistance. It's not a political ideology. It's just a fact. People want to experience the American dream. But asking individuals who are receiving assistance to either get work or look for work, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. And that is what most people think is happening, and they expect that. Look, if you're going to get assistance from the government, you know, we expect you to, you know, be out there looking for work. We'll help you find it. That's why we're investing millions and millions in workforce development. But to simply get a free check and get a pass in terms of having to look for work makes absolutely no sense. So, you know, the goal is to get people off of assistance and get them better jobs and get them into the workforce. But, you know, giving them a pass and saying, you know what, here's your check, you don't have to worry about looking for work, you know, sends the wrong message, certainly to those individuals, but also to taxpayers.
All right, back to the phones we go, and we're gonna hear from someone in in Halley. That is Ron. Ron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. There's a couple of senators, Republican senators, are calling for a referendum before we give out vouchers for the voucher schools, and that is basically representing the people. I was wondering if Scott Souter would go along with that, and I was wondering if he could comment on the Republican representative senators that leave the state and go to ALEC to get model legislation such as voucher schools, and can he deny that that isn't part of ALEC's plan?
All right, thanks for that, Ron. Representative Souter.
I'm getting all the questions. Let me just address, to answer your question with regard to referendums, I won't support that myself in terms of if there's going to be an expansion of charter and choice schools. We don't do referendums for charter schools. We don't do referendums on major policies, whether it's categorical aids or others. Now, we do it for referendum, and we allow that, the people, if they want to invest more. But no, I won't support that. I think that if we're going to give parents a choice, it should be their choice. They should be able to decide where their kid goes, and the money follows. With regard to ALEC is no different than any other organization, such as CSG, Council of State Governments, or NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures. Perfectly legitimate organization. Am I a member of it? You bet. There are Democrats and Republicans that are members of this nationwide, and you know, school choice has been discussed at ALEC, just like it has been discussed at other organizations. So I don't shy away from, you know, stating that I'm a member of ALEC. It is good information. It is open. It's transparent, and it's not funded by taxpayers. So I hope that answers that question too.
All right. Thanks so much, Ron, for the call. Maybe enough time for one more. If If you've got a question for either Representative Souter or Representative Daynell, give us a call at 800.
If I could comment real quickly, Rich, I do think it's sort of ironic that we do force all of our local school districts who have elected school boards that are supposed to be making financial decisions into referendums for additional building projects and to exceed revenue limits and that sort of thing. We force them into these constant series of referendums, which, quite frankly, you know, if we have a representative democracy, we live in a republic, that's what we elect our elected officials to do. But if we're going to force them to do that under those circumstances, I don't think it is unreasonable to say if you want to expand voucher schools into our district and take our taxpayer money and spend it on these private, unaccountable voucher schools, we should have a say. As local citizens, we want to have some input on that. Because if you're going to force our public schools to go to referendum anytime they want to add a new building or put on a new furnace, and then to say that we can't expect some accountability to our local citizens for a voucher school expansion, it's the height of hypocrisy, quite frankly.
A response, Representative Souter, or?
Well, first of all, those individuals that continually say that choice schools are taking from anyone's district, whether it's my district or Chris's or anyone's, it's just not true. By law, that money cannot be taken or robbed from any other school district to fund the choice program. Now, there is taxpayer money that does go to it, but it is not being taken from any particular school district in the state. That's by law. It was written there a number of years ago, and it is a little frustrating when you hear kind of, you know, the teachers union and, you know, some of these other left-wing groups, you know, continually state that. It just isn't the case, and it's a total fabrication. So I hope that that's cleared up as we go along in the debate. The debate should be whether or not parents, you know, who want that choice should be given it. No one's stealing from public schools, but
there is one pot of money.
Injecting competition in the system, I think, is a good thing. I don't think any monopoly, you know, is healthy. And if there's competition, and if parents decide, look, we're going to send our kids to a school because we feel that our child's going to perform better, that should be the parents' choice. And I think that's a good thing. So it's really what the debate is all about, and we'll see how it goes as we move forward in this budget.
Well, the parents' choice is to be able, yeah, if you want to send your – the issue is if the parent wants to send their kid to a private school, that's fine. The question is whether taxpayers should be subsidizing, again, unaccountable institutions that really don't have the same level of accountability and responsiveness that are public and have to meet the same level of standards that most public schools do. That is the question.
But the parents decide the performance, and if the parents decide that school is not performing, they'll go to another institution. But to be given that choice, right now they're not able to use the money that they're paying and through their taxes to have that money follow their kid. It shouldn't automatically go to one institution. That should be the parents' choice. It's their money. It's their child. They should be able to make the choice where they see fit, you know, whether that's a public or private school. In many cases, it will be a public school because, again, many public schools do a great job. But those that don't, maybe they need a little competition, and they also need some help, and there's some money in this budget to help those schools that are underperforming get back to where they should be. So, I think it's a balance, but I think it's an important debate. And if you ask most parents, I think they want to have that decision, and that doesn't mean they're Democrats or Republicans. It just means they care about their kids.
And with that, I'd like to move on to we've got two more points that are topics that I'd like to touch on, and the time is running short. I'm interested, Chris Dano, to hear your thoughts on the DNA database proposal that's included in the governor's budget, and that is a proposal to expand the state's DNA database by requiring DNA testing upon arrest for, I think it's for felonies. I'm not quite sure on the details there, but as a former law enforcement officer, I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I can tell you, as a former law enforcement officer, we understand that you gather a lot of good information essentially by casting a fairly wide net and being able to have a pretty good filter. I mean, that is why one of the top rules in law enforcement is the more contacts you make with the public, the better officer you tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
More contacts lead to more information, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, contacts made by law enforcement that added it, they essentially create a database for law enforcement. Theoretically, it is sound, you know, from being able to do enforcement, being able to just get into a database and find things, it's pretty good. I mean, I understand that. I mean, but by the same token, being a law enforcement officer, I'm also very cognizant of people's civil rights and the rights they do have relative to search and seizure rules. And you know, it's a tricky balancing act because you are it isn't it theoretically can be considered an invasive procedure. That's a small swab, and often the courts will decide what's considered invasive, what's not, whether it's a search, whether it's a seizure, and that area of the law really gets quite interesting and something I've enjoyed dealing with. I find myself of two minds there. I get it as a former cop. I get it as a member of somebody who is also charged with doing what I can to uphold the, take an oath to uphold the state and federal constitutions, and recognizing that, I do have some qualms. But I think, again, the devil may be in the details. I think it may be justified in some circumstances and under some arrest procedures, but you have to make sure you're doing it in a way that where people's rights are adequately protected.
Representative Souter, thoughts on the DNA database?
I'm 100% for it, and if you take a look at what happened, particularly with two of the governor's guests last night, the Zimmerman family, it is an important tool for law enforcement. I have no qualms about the constitutionality. We've talked to the Attorney General about this. We've listened to experts. I'm confident this will pass any constitutional muster. But the point is to solve crimes. The point is to help victims. The point is to make sure that law enforcement has every tool possible, and DNA is a huge tool in their tool chest in order to help solve crime. So I'm 100% for it. Yes, we're putting more money toward it. I think it's going to be a good thing, and I think if you talk to most law enforcement, they'll say, yes, this is a tool we need because victims need help, and police and law enforcement needs every tool they possibly have to be able to solve crimes and prevent tragedies like Brittany Zimmerman.
And with that, we've got 1.5 or just under 1 minute and 15 seconds to talk about mining, iron mining, that is. Representative Souter, today there was a couple of representatives of Clark and Walks of Eau Claire released a statement saying that iron mining, the bills that in their current form, will threaten the state's public trust doctrine relating to navigable waterways. What are your thoughts on that? Very quickly, if you could.
Sure. My thoughts are, look, if you look at actually read the bill and look at the amendments, we protect navigable waters. We define them. We make sure lakes are not filled, lake beds are not filled. Class 1, Class 2, Class 3 trout streams are all protected. The environmental protections, the standards for air and water quality that we have in current law are maintained. In fact, they are strengthened in the bill and the bill's amendments. I am confident this is the right thing to do for the environment. It's the right thing, more importantly, in terms of jobs for our entire state.
All right. Thank you very much. And, gentlemen, I wish I had more time for you, but we don't. That's my time. Democrat State Representative Chris Dano and Republican State Representative Scott Souter, thank you so much for being part of the program. Big thanks to Henry Lippold, Mort Cypress, Grace Fair, and Dean Kallenbeck as well. Next week, we'll talk about a study to reduce phosphorus levels in Lakes Monoman and Taner. This is The West Side. Thanks for listening. All right, gentlemen, you still there? Anybody?